John 18 is where we left off last time, and that's where we'll pick up again today. That kind of gets us in the right area. We'll also be introducing some information from Matthew's account. That's going to be Matthew 26:53, and we will need to be skipping around just a little bit. So let's get some helpers lined up for future passages that we may need. Matthew 26, who wants to be a reader from there at times? Matthew 26, that'll be Jeff, and that's Jeff Burt, thank you. Mark chapter 14, who wants to be our Mark 14 helper when we need aid for Mark 14? That'll be Gary. And then Luke, that's going to be Luke chapter 22. Who wants to be our Luke 22 helper? Luke chapter 22. All right, that'll be Don Harper. And then if we need some references read from John 18, who wants to be our John 18 reader? All right, that'll be Kitty. Okay, let's go back to John chapter 18. There were a couple of things that we didn't get to last week. This is where the crowd has come. Jesus has asked who they want. The people have said, Jesus of Nazareth. The crowd falls back. And then in verses 11 and 12, Jesus therefore said unto Peter, Peter's taken out a sword. He sliced off the ear of the high priest's servant, put up the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father hath given me, shall I not drink it? Don't know if you've ever thought about this or not, but when Jesus healed the servant's ear, how did he do it?
How many ways are there?
Well, would there be more than one?
Yes.
Hmm? Do you think he could have created a new one? Yeah. I wonder. We're not told how he healed the ear. But I think it's interesting, if he didn't pick it up and put it back on, you know, you might, I don't know, maybe you'd have a personal preference, if you're, maybe you wouldn't care if you were in that set of circumstances. But, you know, can you imagine what the miracle would have been like had the ear still been left there wherever it fell, very possibly on the ground, and Jesus attaches or puts on a brand new ear? You've got a new one, and you've got the one that was formerly attached to the body. What an interesting miracle. I don't know that it went that way. But if you've always assumed that Jesus picked up the ear and put it back on, I don't know that that's an assumption that you can prove. There's nothing that I can find in the Bible that would indicate one way or the other. So it's an interesting thought. Then let me, you may have a follow-up thought on that, but let me toss out one other piece of information. Do you think, I mean, obviously the Lord's compassionate, but do you think that there might be another reason why the Lord healed that man's ear? Well, okay, I think that's definitely true. There may be another reason, though, that's a little less obvious.
It might have been to protect Peter, too.
It could be. You know, he's obviously interested in doing that. He will say, you know, let these go their way. We hinted at that last week. So there's that. Anything else, though?
That's a good example.
Well, there's that. What about possibly to avoid distractions? When he's going through all the trials and things, you think that could have become a prominent issue? He's the fella, you know, out there who has disciples that are hacking off the ears of people. That would not have been good to have had that a central issue in the prosecution of Jesus. He needs to be prosecuted for being the Son of God, the claims and so forth, not that he's leading a bunch of insurrectionists. That could have really gone south. So it made perfect sense for the Lord to heal this man. And if that came up, then he could say, I'm definitely not interested in harming people. Look at what I did. And if that ear had been severed and it was still on the ground, possibly that could have even been used as supporting testimony. But certainly with the ear back on the fellow's skull, that left no doubt about the Lord's intention. So a couple of things we didn't discuss last time. Anything else that you want to maybe interject before we move on? Okay, again, we're in John chapter 18. We've read it verses 10 and 11. But there's also this information, as I said, from Matthew's account. Matthew chapter 26, verse 53. And as we're looking at John 18 and how things unfold, Matthew tells us this. Or thinkest thou that I cannot beseech my Father, and he will even now send me more than 12 legions of angels? Jesus said he could beseech, he could ask the Father for how many angels? Not just 12 legions, but he says more than 12 legions. I don't know how many angels that was. 12 legions would have been more than 70,000. You usually have about 6,000 in a legion, so at least 70,000, maybe closer to 72,000. And they were willing to come. Very possibly they were ready to come, but that didn't happen. One of the interesting things that is sometimes not looked at there, when Jesus uses that word legion, what does that sound like as far as a term which has some background? A legion. All right, it sounds like an army. It is actually a military term. Even if you've not served in the military, what do you find as far as structure in the military? It's true even in a business, but it's even more true in the military. What do you find as far as structure? Well, rank, or we might say there's a command. You have somebody at the top, and it just continues to descend until you get to the lowest person or the lowest echelon, right? Got your officers and enlisted all the way down. So when Jesus not only says the Father can send some angels, but the Father can send some legions of angels, what might that hint at in your mind? Legions of angels.
He's a commander.
There's some kind of structure there. We know that not all angels do the same thing. For example, cherubim seem to be God's enforcers. So that would be their division. That would be their specialty, if you will. What do some of the angels, other angels do? I don't know. But it does seem that there, you might use the word classes or types of angels. And that's hinted at by the Lord. Paul also deals with that. Only when you look at the book of Ephesians, for example, when Paul deals with that subject, he has in mind evil angels. And that makes sense. If you're going to have angels doing things, whether those things are involved with righteous activities or those activities are unrighteous, it makes sense to have some kind of structure, makes sense to have some kind of organization. Well, even though those angels could have come, Jesus needed to die on the cross to pay the full price for sin, and neither he nor the Father were willing to, you know, let man not have that salvation. So he was willing to drink that cup. John chapter 18, verse 11. And as you look at Matthew 26, verse 54, one more item from Matthew chapter 26, you have a word or two there that's really important. In that 54th verse, I'll read that as well. He said, "How then should the scriptures be fulfilled? And thus it must be." He said, no angels are going to come because the scriptures need to be fulfilled. And he said, that must take place. We've talked before about that word that's translated must in some places, one of which is here. It's like that word must in John 4:24. Worship must be in spirit and truth. That word must is like that triangle, which must have three sides. You can't have a two-sided triangle, can't have a four-sided triangle. If you've got a triangle, it must have three sides. And Jesus said, this must be done, therefore I must die. Anything that you want to add or ask before we go back to John chapter 18 and see what we have in verse 12? All right. Let's look at that 12th verse. So the band and the chief captain and the officers of the Jews seized Jesus and bound him. You have the soldiers, that of course would be represented by the band. You've got the commanding officer, the chief captain, that word described the commander of 1,000 men. The people that showed up to arrest Jesus, it was not just a couple of folks or some people who didn't have a lot of authority. You also have guards from the Jewish temple, officers of the Jews, and you have these fellas seizing Jesus. Some more modern translations might use the word arrest. That's what they did. They arrest him, and then what's the second step? They next?
Bound
him. Could have been rope, but whatever cords they used to bind him, Jesus allowed himself to be bound by the cords of love. He allowed himself to be humiliated. We often hear that when we have the Lord's Supper as far as the beatings, the insults that were administered. But that humiliation, the embarrassment really begins prior to what we often hear discussed at the Lord's table. It begins here. You have Jesus, the Son of God, deity in the flesh. He allows himself to be arrested. He allows himself to be bound and allows himself to be taken away. But before Jesus is taken away, what does he do? Anybody remember? It's, I'm going to let you have me, but before you haul me off, what's going to occur? I have some things to say. And he does have some things to say. Now, to get these things, we need to take a look at what we have over in Matthew 26. And let's have Matthew 26, 55 and 56 read.
In that same hour said Jesus to the multitudes, "Are you come out as against the thief with swords and staves for to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple, and ye laid no hold on me. But all this was done, that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled."
Okay, a lot packed into that verse, but in that hour, after Jesus has been seized, after he's been arrested, he speaks to whom? To the Multitudes. Remember what we said a couple of weeks ago? Did a dozen or two dozen people come out and arrest the Lord? No, we're dealing with hundreds. I don't think that we're dealing with 1,000 people, but the wording that's used could potentially be understood to describe that large number. But Jesus is speaking to a significant number of folks, and he asks them the question, have you come out against a robber? He said, what are you armed with? You're armed with swords. Do you remember what we said about those swords? Were they the swashbuckler sword that would have been 3 or 4 feet long? No. They were the shorter swords, something like a large hunting knife. But that was what they had. They also had the staves, the clubs. And Jesus recognized, I think this is worth pointing out, he recognized that if they were coming out against a robber, and that word could be translated bandit, it could be translated insurrectionist, someone who's going to be involved with some kind of civil unrest. You see that today with the police. As you look at some of the news that's happened over the last few months, you have a riot in this city, and the police show up with what kind of armament? All right, they're out there maybe with guns, but they're probably out there with billy clubs or other sticks or shields. And Jesus said, you're coming out against me as you would an insurrectionist, somebody who would typically be involved with some kind of mob. And that's what you need to deal with evil people. He recognized that fact, but pointed out that that was not him. Then let me toss out this question for consideration. Maybe you've considered this in the past, maybe not. What if instead of hundreds of people coming out to arrest Jesus, only 2 or 3 or 4, maybe 12 would come out? You think the Lord would have been, or would have allowed himself to have been arrested?
Yes.
Yes. You think he would have allowed himself to have been arrested just as easily as with the hundreds? Yes. So when we look at this crowd that came out to arrest Jesus, it wasn't arrest because of the numbers. That to me is a significant point, but that's something that a lot of times is not mentioned. All right, rather than be like a robber, or rather even be like a thief, like Judas was, John chapter 12, verse 6. Jesus said what? I was with you how often in the temple? I was with you daily. This was a regular activity. And he said there at the end of Matthew 26, verse 55, as I was with you in the temple, what was I doing? Stirring people up? Creating a resurrection? I was simply teaching. Spiritual teaching. A lot of opportunities had existed, but the people did not want to arrest the Lord, and now things had radically changed. So why were things so different? What had changed? They come out now. They come out now at what time of day? It's night, in contrast to when he had been there at the temple during the day. And they come out with how many people? Bunches, this great multitude of people, likely hundreds, and why so much weaponry? Well, the answer is found in the scriptures. Mark 14, verse 49. Okay, and after that, after Gary reads that, we'll take a look at Matthew 26, 56 one more time. I know Jeff read that as well, but we'll go back to it once more.
I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you took me not, but the scriptures must be fulfilled.
Okay. Why did the people do this? Jesus said, because of the scriptures. They had to be fulfilled. This is what was prophesied. You could go back to Isaiah 53, other passages, and Jesus said this is why that's occurring. Jeff, one more time, if you would, Matthew 26, verse 56.
In that same hour, said Jesus to the multitudes, are you come out as against a thief with sword and staves for to take me? I sat daily with you, teaching in a temple, and you laid no hold on me.
Hmm. Okay, I may have had the wrong reference there. I wanted information.
Oh, wait, I read 55.
Oh, okay.
Let's try it again.
Okay, I was going to say something didn't.
But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled.
There it is. I'm just going to stop you right there. That not just the scriptures, Mark 14, 49, but the scriptures of the prophets. So Jesus said the Bible taught this. And a specific part of the Bible which taught this was the prophetical books. This information had been predicted hundreds of years in advance. It had to be fulfilled, and Jesus said, it is now being fulfilled. So Peter, put up your sword. Let these guys do what they're going to do, because this is going to fulfill God's will. Ultimately, it's going to help people. Now, in just a minute, we're going to look at Luke 22. But any thoughts that you want to add or ask before we head over there? Okay. Now here's a statement that's specific to Luke. Luke 22, verse 53. We want to pay especially close attention to the latter part of that verse.
When I was daily with you in the temple, you stretched forth no hand against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness.
Okay, now think about those words. Jesus said to these people, this is your hour. This is your time. This is your opportunity. God is giving you your chance, and this is it. But your chance, the opportunity that you're seizing, it is the hour, it is the power of darkness. That was the Lord's assessment of what was taking place in the garden. Now, when you think about those words, this is the hour and the power of darkness, what do you think that darkness was? How would you define that word? The darkness would have been?
Evil.
All right, evil, I think that's a good word. What else?
Satan.
All right, evil, Satan, sin, ignorance, godlessness, all of those things. We remember from 1 John chapter 1, verse 5, that in God there is no darkness. So everything that was taking place was, not according to righteousness. God's will, yes, but the people were acting unrighteously. Now, thankfully, this was not the last hour. Sometimes people will have their day and their opportunity to do some bad things, but another hour, another day is coming, and that is certainly true for the righteous. Anything else that you want to add or ask before we look a little further? Okay. Back, and we find this in Matthew 26, 56, Mark chapter 14, verse 50, and the prophecy is Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7. But let's see what happens, Matthew 26, 56. Jeff, let's go back to you. Read that again.
When all this was done, that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled, and then all the disciples...
Okay, that's all right. Gary,
all the disciples forsook him and fled.
Okay, that's it. How many of the disciples?
All.
And what did they do? They fled. They forsook the Lord. Now, Luke mentions something that's useful. Luke chapter 22, verse 54. Let's see what he says. Now, you might think from what we had in Matthew 26:56, that all the disciples, they scattered and didn't want anything more to do with Jesus. That's not true. They do leave. They do flee. But Peter, and you see here, Jeff Martin had asked this question, I think, in last time's class, that you have sort of a mixture, a strange mixture with people. On the one hand, it seems like there's good and evil. You have fear and cowardice on the hands of some others. And that's what you have here with Peter. On the one hand, he's fleeing, he's running. But on the other hand, what's he doing from Luke's account? He's also
following.
And Luke uses the imperfect tense to say that he was continually following. Now, he doesn't want to be too close. But neither does he want to completely abandon the Lord. So he's still sort of clinging on. And then you have this unusual statement, Mark chapter 14, verses 51 and 52. And let's see what we've got in Mark's account. 14, 51 and 52. Okay, so Jesus being arrested, soon to head off to the first part of his trials. Peter's following afar off, doesn't want to be too close. John's going to come into the mix here pretty soon. But you also now have this additional man, this young man. And he's not specifically identified. We have more information about what he was wearing. He's called a young man. A lot of people, and I am also inclined to believe this, that the person here was Mark, John Mark. The same fellow who wrote the book of Mark, where we're getting this information from. And Mark is also following him for a little bit. But then, what disrupts him? Some people come along and grab him. And, well, if we were in that situation, we'd probably want to flee. That was his reaction as well. And what happens to him?
Loses his clothes.
All right, he loses his clothes. They grab onto the clothes or grab onto him, the cloth. And that's the only thing that he's wearing. When you look at that word, which is translated linen cloth, you find that applied to Jesus. That's what his body was wrapped in, Matthew 27:59. Mark and Luke also mention that detail. And, if you've got that wrap, it's like a towel. You've got the towel wrapped around your body, and somebody snatches a towel, and you do some grabbing and pulling, and what's going to happen to the towel? It's going to come off, and there you are, right there, completely bare. So, as you look at Mark 14, verse 52, the Bible says that man fled naked. Not every time in the Bible where you have the word naked does it mean completely without clothing. But there are some who believe that in this particular passage, it does mean naked, fully nude, that he did not have on a stitch of clothing. And that's at least possible, if not probable. When you go back and you look at the Lord, he said that he was going to suffer at the hands of Jews and Gentiles, Matthew 20, verses 18 and 19, Mark 10, verse 33. That's exactly what you see when we look at the garden. He said that was going to fulfill Old Testament prophecy, Luke 18, verse 31. And again, he comes back to that. The scriptures must be fulfilled. He was exactly right. One source made this statement, which I'm going to give you the quote. I like it. He called this the lowest point in all history. Judas had betrayed him. Peter had denied him. 10 apostles ran for cover. 4 puppet rulers. Now, this goes ahead a little bit, but this sums up where we are and where we're headed. 4 puppet rulers, Annas, Caiaphas, Pilate, and Herod, judged the judge, and the deeply respected Sanhedrin became a lynch mob. The holiest city, Jerusalem, and the city of law, Rome, united to produce the greatest legal farce in history. That pretty well sums up everything that we've been looking at and all the places where we're going to be headed. So it's a very, very sad time, very, very tragic time, but also a very, very fascinating set of circumstances. Anything that you want to contribute before we move on a little further? Gary, and then we'll take Ray's hand.
The Mark, including the comment about the guy that ran off and lost his towel, do you think he included that to show a correlation of how fast the apostles ran off?
It could be, or at least how intense it was.
Yeah.
I mean, when people are willing to, flee without clothing, not stay around and see if somebody will give them, something to wear. I mean, there's usually great fear. Or a person's so intoxicated they're not thinking clearly. And that, I think, we can eliminate as far as a possibility here. So, yes. Yeah. And you could go back and point out some of those stories in the Bible. Now, in his case, it was for a really good reason. Didn't want to commit fornication with Potiphar's wife. Here, ultimately, especially if it was Mark, we're glad that he did have a chance to escape, especially if he wrote the book of Mark. That is very helpful to us. But, like I say, he was trying to follow afar off. And as a young man, very commendable. So you have to look at him and say, thumbs up in many respects. But he did pay a price. And that probably was really, really memorable. And that may have been one of the reasons why, if it was him, he included that in his book. Didn't want to, like John, didn't want to identify himself specifically, but did want to include some of those key details. Anybody else? All right, let's go over to the book of Mark. This is going to be as far as where we're going to read from the balance of our study tonight. We'll also try to, at times, tie in some additional material. We've already looked at Mark 14, 51, and 52. You've got this young man following Jesus, the linen cloth. The people lay hold on him. He leaves the linen cloth, he flees naked. And then as you look at 53, here's the additional point. And they led Jesus away to the high priest. And there come together with him all the chief priests and the elders and the scribe. Remember from John chapter 18, verse 12. Jesus has been seized and he's also been bound. He's been tied up. So whether that was ropes or something else, he has been, quote unquote, captured. Now, if you were one of the authorities, had you been in that group of hundreds of people, and maybe you were somewhat knowledgeable of Jesus about all the miracles that he'd performed, and remember the statement by Judas, get him securely, that we talked about in last time's class? If you're one of the authorities that had been involved with that mob, how might you have been thinking at this point?
That the soldiers take care of it. I'm going to take my distance.
All right. I think that would have been one thing. With that, too, though, you might have been thinking that was a lot easier than we thought. No lightning bolts came down from heaven. We were able to get him, and there was a fellow who lost his ear, but still, that was restored somehow. So all things have gone reasonably well. So by the time Jesus gets to the first stage of his trial, and that's what we're looking at right here, they might have been breathing, in some respects, a sigh of relief. So the Lord allows himself to be taken. First of all, he goes to Annas. That would have been the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. We know that from John chapter 18, verse 13. And John 18, 14, which we didn't read, you also find in that passage this statement. Caiaphas was the man who had given counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people rather than the whole nation perish. So Jesus, it's sort of like in politics today. You might be, if you're in a certain position, you might be liked by somebody, But if it looks like the election's going to be lost, or if it looks like something is going to be really costly, what's the older expression? They threw me under the bus. And that's sort of how they were looking at Jesus. Better for one man to die, better to throw him under the bus, better to treat him in a way that's unjust than for many others to suffer. So Jesus, Luke chapter 22, verse 54, it says he was taken to the house. And Mark 14, verse 53, that tells us that that house belonged to the high priest. And there you have all these people coming together. The chief priests, the elders, the scribes, and the word all is important. Now when you start studying what happened to Jesus, anybody know how many illegal proceedings, or let's dump the word illegal, how many proceedings he had? All of them were illegal. How many trials he had? Six. An easy way to remember that. What's that number that a lot of people don't like? 666. So if you can remember that number, just remember Jesus. Not that he had 666 or 66, but he has six different illegal trials or proceedings. Some of them were civil. Some of them were religious. So don't look at his trials and say they were all from the Jews or they were all from the Gentiles. There was a mixture. Jesus, we know this from John chapter 18, verses 12 through 14, where we just were. He first appears before Annas. And you might think of that as a preliminary hearing. Today, if you are involved with the court system, if there is a criminal complaint, you're picked up for something, you might go for a preliminary hearing. That's kind of what Jesus had. Then he goes over to see Caiaphas. That also would have been something that the Jews experienced. Let's pick that up from Matthew chapter 26, verses 57 and 58. Jeff, we'll go back to you for that. You might compare this to an arraignment.
56, 57, 58?
Yeah.
And they that laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace, and went in, and sat with the servants to see the end.
Okay, so you have Annas, as we said. He's going to be involved with the preliminary hearing. Now you have Caiaphas. He's going to be involved with the arraignment. And then, Jeff, let's move ahead. Matthew 27, let's look at the first two verses and see how after Annas, after Caiaphas, Jesus now goes before the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, the High Court for the Jews.
Okay. 27:1.
1 and 2.
When the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor.
Okay. So, you can see the sequence. Annas, Caiaphas, next step, the Jewish High Court. What did the Jewish High Court think about Jesus? Good guy or bad guy? He needs to die. Why didn't it stop with the Jewish High Court? Why didn't they just put him to death?
They're not allowed to do that.
Okay, not allowed to do that. So if you're not allowed to do that, and you're a Jew, and you've gone up to that highest level, your greatest court, now it's going to have to flip over where? Now it's going to have to flip over from the religious over to the civil. And what power was going to take responsibility for the civil proceedings? That was going to be the Romans. So, three aspects to the Jewish trials of Jesus. Annas, Caiaphas, Sanhedrin. The first one that gets to see him, as far as the Romans, will be who?
Pontius Pilate.
Pilate has some interaction with him. And wants to, after the interaction, pass it off. So who's Pilate send the Lord over to? Let's ship him off to Herod. And Herod had wanted to see Jesus. So Herod spent some time with him. But Herod doesn't want to deal with him. So what happens? He now comes back to Pilate. That's time number six. And after Pilate finishes up with the Lord that second time, then, of course, Jesus is going to be sent on his way to be crucified. So that's a quick summarization. It's in a nutshell what we're going to be looking at. When you start looking at the procedures, and I'm no lawyer by any stretch of the imagination, but when you start looking at the proceedings that Jesus went through, both from a biblical perspective and both from the perspective of Jewish culture, Jewish laws in that day and time, you have a number of illegal procedures. That's important even in our time. If you have a case brought against you and you're being prosecuted, what might be one of the things? For example, let's say that you are stopped and the police do a search and they find something that's illegal. Depending on how things go, If you have an attorney that goes into court and wants to give you a vigorous defense, what might that attorney argue about the search? It was an illegal search. And for that reason, the search has to be thrown out. The search cannot be considered. So when you start looking at the trials of Jesus, the proceedings, there were many irregularities. There were many illegal proceedings. I didn't bring it. But one of the books that I have, as far as the trial of Jesus, it was written by an attorney. The thing is that thick. It's 700 pages thick. Now think about that. 700 pages thick. And the only thing that this guy deals with would be the trials, the various legal aspects of what Jesus experienced. So this was a big, big deal. You have some wrongs on the Roman side of things. They didn't follow all the laws they should have. We'll point out some of these as we go along. You also have some laws that were not followed by the Jews, and they were just as guilty as the Romans. Now let's go back for just a second to where we were some time ago in the book of Acts. Let's take a look at Acts 2. You might not think that there's much in the book of Acts, especially the second chapter, about Jesus being treated illegally. But Peter, he's there. As we've already started to see, we'll see a little bit more about this. And on the day of Pentecost, this is what he says, Acts 2, verse 23. He says, him, now Peter's talking to a Jewish audience, him being delivered up by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, ye by the hand of who? Lawless men did crucify and slay. What would make a person a lawless man? You're not following the law. And that's exactly what we're starting to read about. These fellas, both Jews, who are the focus in Acts chapter 2, and Gentiles that were not focused on in Acts chapter 2, they were involved in many illegal proceedings. I'll give you this quote as well, which I like. In the Jewish system of courts, there were three kinds of tribunals. There was a three-judge court, which was the lowest and most elementary form of government. This corresponded roughly to our local justice of the peace courts, or to our municipal courts. Today, next above this lowest court, there existed in many of the cities and wherever the people desired and approved it, a junior Sanhedrin council, which consisted of 23 judges. Then over and above these courts was the senior or major Sanhedrin council, consisting of 71 judges. That's the group that Jesus appeared before. Qualifications for men of the senior Sanhedrin were exactly prescribed by the law. Jewish law provided for these three separate kinds of courts, and they existed and commonly tried cases within their respective jurisdictions. So Jesus should have faced some very standardized procedures rather than these fellows making some things up as they went along. But that's not what happened to him. Anything that you want to add or ask before we start looking at Peter's first denial? Brian?
I think it's interesting, at least in the Jewish ones we looked at, I think each of them has indicated full participation.
Yeah.
All of the chief priests and scribes, you know, everybody that was put that had a seat was there.
Yeah. The only exception.
No one wanted to miss it, or
yeah. Nicodemus may have been an exception to that in some respect, but aside from him, who had some faith in Jesus, you're right. Everybody was there. Each person was on board. It wasn't that there. You know, we have a Supreme Court now. Oftentimes, it has a split decision. It's right down the middle. That's not what we're dealing with here. Everybody was saying, "Let's get rid of him." You're exactly right. Anybody else? All right, let's go back to Mark chapter 14 and see what we have in that next verse. Mark 14, verse 54. And Peter had followed him afar off, even within, into the court of the high priest. And he was sitting with the officers and warming himself in the light of the fire. Jesus begins to face his illegal proceedings, these six religious trials that we talked about. It's been estimated that as you look at all the places where the Lord went, he probably had to walk about 2.5 miles. Peter, we have him following afar off. We talked about that imperfect action, Luke 22, verse 54, and it seems like he did not want to get too close. So he's vacillating. I want to stay involved, but I'm still a little bit concerned. Matthew also mentions the following with the imperfect, Matthew 26, verse 58. And he words it slightly differently. Let's go back there, Jeff. Matthew 26, verse 58. It sounds almost kind of fatalistic. Peter's following him, but Matthew gives us a specific reason for that. Let's see what it is.
26:58. But Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace and went in and sat with the servants to see the end.
Okay. What's that sound like? Waited to see the end. Sounds a little bit like a movie, doesn't it? A TV show. Well, just five more minutes. Let's wait and see what the end is going to be. Not sure all the things that may have been going on through Peter's mind at this point, but it certainly did not sound from what you have there in Matthew's account like he was thinking positive things. Now, when you go back a little bit, last week's class and the first part of tonight's class, Peter, what had he just done? He'd cut off an ear. You think some people noticed? I would say some people probably knew that. Now, if you had just cut off somebody's ear, and there had been all these important people around, where do you think you might go? Or where do you think you might not go? I don't think I would be anywhere close to the Lord. Do you? I would think I'd really want to stay away. But that's not what we find with Peter. And maybe this was his impulsive nature. But he gets close to the fire, literally and physically. Now maybe he did that because remember the people who came against the Lord? What did they have? Well, they had the weapons, but what else did they have? They had lights, didn't they? Remember the torches? What would that suggest about the evening? It may have been pretty dark. Maybe Peter was thinking, the darkness will hide me. Well, in contrast to what we have going on with Peter, we have another disciple. Let's keep our place here in Mark and go over to the book of John for a second. Now, John may be a little bit like Peter, or Mark. John and Mark may be a little similar. Remember from Mark 14, we talked about that young man. Mark didn't identify him. He's the fellow who loses his clothing and is naked there. John chapter 18, verse 15. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. John doesn't specify who that disciple was. He may, though, be doing the same thing that Mark did. John, I think, was probably talking about himself just as Mark was talking about himself. Whoever this other disciple was, you may believe it was John, the author of this book, you may believe that it was someone else. But 18:15 says, that disciple was what? He was known. That's an important word. That word means he was familiar with, he was acquainted with, maybe he was on intimate terms with who? The high priest and his family. That's an unusual detail. Here you have someone connected to Jesus, very possibly the Apostle John, connected to the family of the high priest. What would cause a person to be known to someone who's in power? You're known to the mayor. You're known to a state senator. You're known to someone at the federal level. All right, it could be that you have some blood relation, and that's possible here. What else?
Large business owner.
Okay, you could have a business connection. You're involved with something that has attracted the interest of a politician. Maybe you have a great deal of money and have helped someone finance a campaign. So John's family may have been wealthy or certainly influential, and that could account for his or whoever this other disciple is. Peter, though, didn't have that access. So John sort of goes to bat for him. Peter's there lurking a little bit. John can get into this area where Jesus is. So what's John do? Gets Peter in the gate, so to speak. And today that same kind of thing still happens. All right, as Peter enters into the gate area, look at John chapter 18, verse 17. The maid, therefore, that kept the door, you know, you're not going to get in unless you are authorized. John paves the way for Peter. As you look at John 18, verse 16, we could have read that too. Who was known unto the high priest, he went out and spake unto her that kept the door, and he brings in Peter. And as Peter's coming in, because John gets him in, John knows the high priest's family, the maid, therefore, that kept the door, saith unto Peter, art thou also one of the man's disciples? How do you think Peter felt at that minute? Yeah, I think scared is probably a really good way to describe it. And what's his response? Not me. Remember how many denials by Peter?
Three.
Guess which one this one is? Number one. So this is Peter's first strike. As you start looking at the other details, you have this information, Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke chapter 22, and as we start looking at those additional accounts, we'll find some other points that need to be brought out. As you continue with John's account for just a minute, keeping in mind what we have in Mark 14, John chapter 18, verse 18, Peter gets in the gate. Now the servants and the officers were standing there, having made a fire of coals. Why did they have a fire of coals? It was cold. You know, John's the only one to give us that information, I believe. And they were warming themselves, and who? Peter was doing what? Was with them, standing and warming himself. It might have been dark, John 18, verse 3, but when you have a cold evening, generally what's going to be true of your fire? You're going to probably have a nice fire. So Peter is there, standing with the guards, the officials. It's cold, and putting himself really in harm's way. So, as I said, you really have to look at this fellow. A lot of things may have been going through his mind. Very, very interesting that he does all of this. As you look at Matthew 26, verse 58, let's go back there, Jeff, for just a second, if you would read that for us. And then we'll also look at Luke 22, verse 55. Matthew 26, 58.
Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace and went in and sat with the servants to see the end.
Okay, he's sitting with the servants. That is expressed with the imperfect tense. He's not just standing there at times, but now he's also sitting down with them, and you've got the fire going. If you want to avoid capture, if you want to stay consistent with that denial, I don't know the man. This was probably not the wisest move. And Luke chapter 22, verse 55. An important enough detail that you also have it mentioned there, down there with them. All right, let's go back to the book of John for a second. And I apologize for skipping around, but I mean, that's how God chose to lay it out. So if we're going to get the details in order, we need to be moving around a little bit. As this is taking place, John 18:19 says, "The high priest therefore asked Jesus of his disciples and of his teaching." You've probably seen or heard someone being arrested. They're taken down to the police station and they're questioned. The police have some questions. That's essentially what happened to the Lord. He's arrested. He's taken down to this area. And now some people, Anna specifically, are asking some questions about Jesus. He has, and as you look down at verse 24 in that same chapter, I think you've got an additional point. Annas therefore sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. So there is this period of inquisition. Back here in John 18, 19, though, Annas wanted to know about Jesus' disciples, his followers, plus the Lord's what else?
Teaching.
Why do you think he wanted to know about the Lord's teaching?
See if there's any blasphemy.
Well, okay, I think that would have been important. Anything else?
Maybe he was curious.
It could have been curiosity. If you're going to accuse Jesus, and you're going to have a good case to make against him when it comes to the Romans, what do you want to pin on him? The Romans are not going to care about the religious stuff. That's important to you. But if you're going to make your case, stick with the Romans.
You need facts.
But what kind of facts?
Truth.
Well, but the specific charges.
That they're putting his own thoughts over the law, over the Roman law.
Okay.
Treason.
Take that. Okay, treason and maybe insurrection. The Romans aren't going to care about anything unless the people are stirring up peace. But if you are an insurrectionist, if you are out there doing the kinds of things which are going to create an uprising, then that's going to get attention. Wise authorities are always on the lookout for people who are going to be rabble-rousers and stirring up trouble. So, important to ask about Jesus' teaching. What are you trying to instruct people with? Well, the Lord's already made that point. He said, "I was with you how often? Daily. Where was I? In the temple." This was not secret information. You guys heard, you could have come at any time and heard exactly what I was teaching. But then you have this other detail in John 18, verse 19. He was asked about his disciples. Think that could have been a problem? We're not going to just hold on to you. Who else, depending on what you say, are we going to come after? We're going to get those men. The men who were supposed to be taking the gospel into the world just a little later. We're not told all that Annas asked, but it's not difficult to imagine how some of the questions might have been. How many disciples do you have? Where are they? If they've left, where did they go? What are they now doing? What did you command them to do? And so forth. All those questions would have been very, very reasonable.